extending.
Right.
At
Perry, the in Ohio, the bus drivers passed a resolution. I mean, they just signed a petition and said, you know, if there's a meltdown at Perry, we're not driving the buses. They said, forget it, we're not going to do it. And they didn't stop the NRC, but nonetheless, it was very powerful. So you may want to you might want to poll the bus drivers and ask them, are you guys really going to, if Indian Point goes, are you really going to drive the buses, or are you going to get out of town? Right. Right. It just ain't going to happen. Nutrition editor to put it down, and then they wrote an edit. Actually, now I remember, a year after the accident, there was a very brave op editor there named, her name escapes me now, Charlotte Curtis. And she actually agreed to publish an op ed that I wrote. And I wanted to say outright that people were killed at Three Mile Island and that the infant death rate in Harrisburg tripled. She made me write it so that, the animals were killed. And, you know, there's tremendous evidence at Three Mile Island that there was a devastating impact on the farm population of animals. And, you know, one of the excuses that the nuclear power industry used to say that there were no human casualties was it was all psychological and people were reading the papers and flipping out, right? But somehow the cows and the chickens, this didn't seem to apply. Although they have pretty smart cows and chickens in central Pennsylvania, but not that smart. And so I wrote in this editorial, I wrote in my first draft that A, that people were killed at Three Mile Island, and B, that farm animals died. And she made me back that up and say that some people think people were killed and some people think farm animals died. And then under great, you know, duress, she nonetheless printed my op-ed. And in retaliation, the Times editorial staff ran a left side editorial, you know, a staff editorial, called Goat Stories from Three Mile Island, in which they put down the whole concept that anyone or any animals were harmed at Three Mile Island. And the Sulzbergers, you know, there's been some reasonable coverage over the years. They're still better than most, tragically. I mean, you know, you can still get Matt Wald or somebody else to write a decent piece from time to time. You know, they do pretty well on nuclear weapons issues, actually. But there's something going on there. It doesn't make sense. And they've been really, as you know, they've been very negative about shutting Indian Point.
I would like to praise the Journal News at the same time.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. I don't know the answer for the New York Times, but you just got to keep plugging away. And do not underestimate the power of the Internet. When I wrote my first article, the big article that I, you know, thought was important after the jet crashes and I put it out on the web, and it went. You know, it came back to me dozens of times from other lists. I actually went out to Minnesota to speak. When I got off the plane, it was on the front page of the alternative paper that I didn't know. They didn't ask me, that's for sure. What's that? Oh, we have copies of that here. So, see, the Internet goes even further. So don't underestimate the power of the web. You know, stuff does circulate it, but I don't know what's going to happen with the New York Times. Sooner or later, they're going to have to come around. I don't know how. Totally massive reduction in danger to the population. Theoretically, or in real terms, you know, a terrorist could hit the spent fuel pools and cause major damage, and that is a serious problem. But the first and most important step is to shut the reactors. They are volatile, they are dangerous, they are unstable, they are capable of infinite harm. And, you know, you hear some people say, well, it won't make any difference because you still got the stuff in the reactor and you still got the stuff. Stop, shut the reactors. That is 90% of the battle. You can deal with the rest of it later. You have got to shut the reactors. There are so many ways those reactors can go haywire. You don't need a terrorist attack, unfortunately. We've had accidents. We've had, Fermi almost blew up in 1966. INEL in Idaho. Browns Ferry. Chernobyl, Three Mile Island, how much more do we need? You know, they got to shut. That's the first priority. They have to shut down, and shutting them down will massively reduce the damage.
Two more questions.
Yes, Noah. When they close. The big problem, one of the big problems, and one of the reasons we're so concerned about the deregulation fund, is that there's a built-in incentive in their having this deregulation money against shutting the plant. Because the longer they can hold on to that deregulation money, the more games they can play with it. And one of the games that we know they will play with it, knowing how corporate lawyers operate, is they will try and decouple that money from the actual act of decommissioning. So that when push comes to shove, and there's always the bankruptcy laws, and there's always these nooks and crannies in the corporate law, and we are afraid that they will run off with the decommissioning money, when push comes to shove, there's two corporations.
Two separate LLCs under the
LLC is a limited liability corporation.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, so they've got the fixes in, and so the longer they can avoid having to decommission, the longer they can play with the money and not face a court battle over what happens to the money, and the more stretch they can get to declare bankruptcy and leave you sitting with the reactor. And that's got to be the plan. That has to be the plan. And the quicker you get on it with your lawyers and accountants, the faster they'll be held to account, and maybe the faster we can cut that off at the pass. Got to happen.
It's being done. It's happening all.
Two states, Massachusetts and Ohio, have community choice in their dereg bill. But in this brave new world of energy deregulation and the real revolution that has occurred in renewables, all this is possible. And a lot of it is uncharted waters. And sooner or later, we're going to find the exact right formula. And I think that that's why I mentioned it at the top, this bond issue that passed in San Francisco, extremely important. On that same ballot in San Francisco, there was legal language that was voted on to take over Pacific Gas and Electric. And the vote was virtually 50-50, and I got to tell you that whole ballot boxes were found in San Francisco Bay. I mean, this is a throwback. This made Mayor Daley look like a piker. And we lost that, I think, by less than 1,000 votes. It was really tight and very clearly stolen. And there's always that option of going to public power, and that is the thing that can really freak them out. And it's something you can talk about. But yes, cities, towns, and counties do have the option under deregulation of generating their own power and unhooking from the nuclear grid. And it's another thing that will clearly offer an avenue of going to shut down. Thank you very much. I'll be around.
That was Harvey Wasserman speaking on March 6th in Garrison, New York. Thanks to Eric for that tape. You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, or WXXC Truxton. This is Unwelcome Guests. Up next, The Wizards of Money.
Off to see the wizard, the wonderful Wizard of Oz. We hear he is a wizard of a whiz, if ever a whiz there was. If ever, oh, ever a whiz there was, the Wizard of Oz is one. Because of the wonderful things he does. We're off to see the wizard, the wonderful Wizard of Oz.
This is The Wizards of Money, your money and financial management series, but with a twist. My name is Smithy, and I'm a wizard watcher in the land of Oz. This is the 10th edition of The Wizards of Money, and it is entitled Back to the 20s Through the Looking Glass Steagall. In this, the 10th edition of Wizards, we're going to take a look at the parallels between current times and the late 1920s, the period just before the great stock market crash of 1929, and the subsequent Great Depression. We will see how it is that much of the regulation implemented during the Great Depression to address the wild and unregulated behavior of big business during the 20s has now been dismantled through deregulation. Despite industry claims that such regulation is outdated and no longer needed for our fancy modern markets, we will see that, not surprisingly, the dismantling of this regulation has once again given rise to exactly the same dangerous market behavior it was designed to stop.
Primarily, this is because the rulers of the exchange of mankind's goods have failed through their own stubbornness and their own incompetence. Have admitted their failure and have abdicated. Practices of the unscrupulous money changers stand indicted in the court of public opinion, rejected by the hearts and minds of men. Faced by failure of credit, They have proposed only the lending of more money, stripped of the lure of profit by which to induce our people to follow their false leadership. They have resorted to exhortations, pleading tearfully for restored confidence. They only know the rules of a generation of self-seekers. They have no vision. Yes, the money changers have fled from their high seats in the temple of our civilization. And there must be an end to a conduct in banking and in business, which too often has given to a sacred trust the likeness of callous and selfish wrongdoing. Small wonder that confidence languishes. We require two safeguards against a return of the evils of the old order. There must be a strict supervision of all banking and credits and investments. There must be an end to speculation with other people's money. And there must be provision for an adequate but sound currency. These, my friends, are the lines of attack.
This excerpt from FDR's, or Franklin Roosevelt's, 1933 speech helps remind us of a time when financial collapse caused by unchecked and unregulated behavior of Wall Street gamblers forced America's political leadership to publicly recognize the danger such activity poses to the public as a whole. But how easily we forget these things. In the wake of the undoing of what became regulated during the FDR administration, the same old players are back to their same old tricks of the 20s. Hardly discussed in all the coverage of the Enron saga of the early 21st century is the discovery of the extent of the wild and risky behavior of the biggest federally insured banks in the United States, namely J.P. Morgan Chase, Citigroup, and Bank of America. If their involvement in financing various Enron activities is any indication of their wheeling and dealing more broadly, then we have a lot to be worried about at the heart of the financial system. In this highly deregulated market, it is appropriate to look at the implications for another 1929-style crash and the potential for a financial collapse. The 29 crash followed the high-stakes risk-taking of lightly regulated, powerful industries. One must consider, would a financial collapse like this be a good thing, by being possibly the only way to change the global order? Or would the first such collapse in the nuclear age bring more violence and destruction than any of us ever thought possible? Of course, nobody can answer these last two questions with any certainty, but it is very important to consider what might go into the makings of a global financial collapse and to plan for what is eventually going to happen anyway. It is not a question of whether or not it will happen, as all financial systems eventually collapse. The question is when and how. To go on this journey, we will hear some speeches from important figures from this time, and we will also visit with someone that actually lived through the 20s and is still able to tell us about it today. First, let's discuss some regulatory landmarks of the Great Depression. The Great Depression brought with it numerous regulatory landmarks that stayed with us for a long time afterward. Let's talk about a sample of four of the major areas of this regulation and the status of them today. First of all, utilities regulation. In 1935, the Public Utilities Holding Company Act was introduced to provide national supervision of the gas and electricity utilities in order to prevent their excesses of the 1920s from happening again. In the 20s, big utilities had been buying up smaller ones. They'd been hiking up consumer prices, expanding into unrelated businesses, loading up on debt, hiding losses from investors, and milking their subsidiaries and affiliates to prop up their own earnings. Sound familiar? Many people have reminded us of this law in the aftermath of the Enron collapse and Enron's various exemptions from it amidst recent recommendations by everyone from the Senate Banking Committee to the SEC to have this law repealed. Second, exchange and accounting regulation. The Securities and Exchange Commission, or SEC, was established in 1934 under the Securities Exchange Act. During the 1920s, there was effectively no federal oversight of the securities markets, and with the market rising in the 20s and banks more than willing to lend for stock speculation, this created a recipe for disaster. The SEC was created to oversee market players in the securities markets and to require truthful quarterly reporting from publicly traded companies. By 2002, the effectiveness of the SEC in enforcing so-called truth in reporting is highly questionable, as we have seen. This is in part due to conflicts of interest rife throughout the financial world, but also due to the sheer complexity of financial transactions available to all companies and the absence of regulation on the most risky of financial transactions, those transactions called derivatives trades. The third area is Social Security. Before the Great Depression, there was no federal safety net for unemployed, disabled, or retired persons. As often happens today, the safety net was usually picked up by various charities and religious organizations. But this safety net collapsed during the Great Depression because of the collapse of the financial system. By necessity, and through public pressure that had built up over the years, the Social Security Act was born in 1935 and provided for old age and unemployment benefits. Today, of course, this Depression-era safeguard is under attack, with financial companies pushing for its privatization. The fourth area and the focus of our study today is the regulation concerning the heart of the financial system. This is the big one. This is the regulation of the system that stands at the heart of the entire financial infrastructure, the banking system. The big act affecting banks and securities dealers in this period was the Glass-Steagall Act of 1933 that brought radical changes and better supervision to the banking industry. This act separated deposit banks, where depositors expect to safely park their money, from more speculative players such as securities dealers and investment banks that could make depositors' money disappear through careless gambling. And they did exactly this in the 1920s. The Federal Depository Insurance Corporation, or FDIC, was also set up in 1933 to provide insurance on depositors' funds in the event of bank failure. This was necessary to restore confidence in the foundations of the monetary system, the banks. These banks had just seen run after run, failure after failure, and depositors had seen their money disappear right before their very eyes. These regulations of the banking system, the heart and soul of the financial system, will be the focus of our show today. We will see how the gradual dismantling of these regulations over the past 20 years since Ronald Reagan took office in 1980 and culminating in the complete repeal of the once mighty Glass-Steagall Act in 1999, is sending the banks straight back to be bigger reflections of their 1929 former selves. Whatever are the implications of all this? As already noted, a glimpse of what the future might hold already leaked out amidst the Enron crisis. We are only just starting to understand the extent of the involvement of big federally insured banks in this scandal, notably JP Morgan Chase, Citigroup, Bank of America, all of whom were able to form banking and securities trading conglomerates after the repeal of Glass-Steagall. Much of the source material on the 1920s used for this episode of Wizards is actually from the website of the Library of Congress. This site has a very extensive selection of original documents scanned into electronic files and posted to the web. For the 1920s era, there is a fascinating collection called The Coolidge Era and the Consumer Economy, and links to this are posted to the Wizards of Money website at www.wizardsofmoney.org. Now imagine we're back in the 20s. World War I is over, the Republican Harding is president, and the decade started glumly with what is known as the Agricultural Depression. Radio was the new mass communications medium of the 1920s. The Westinghouse Company launched the first radio station, KDKA, in 1920 in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Radio brought with it great promise as the medium for free speech and democracy, but these promises were never fulfilled in the 20s, as we shall see. Campaign finance and corruption scandals rocked the Harding administration, the most famous scandal being the Teapot Dome scandal, whereby government officials had secretly leased public oil fields to private interests in return for cash and other favours. Harding had an unfortunate incident with some food in 1923. He dropped dead and Calvin Coolidge became president and served as such until 1928. The Coolidge administration favoured deregulation, industry self-regulation, and brought in tax cuts to stimulate spending. AT&T, NBC, and CBS built huge radio networks across the country that grew rapidly in the last half of the decade. These networks were all supported by advertising revenue, and this tended to dumb down the content so as not to offend the major revenue sources. The public relations industry and major corporate propaganda campaigns were launched. Spearheading much of this activity was a man named Edward L. Bernays, who wrote papers called, quote, The Business of Propaganda, end quote, and helped Coolidge get elected in 1924. Advertising in newspapers and radio claimed unprecedented proportions of print space and airtime. Various movements to encourage ever more spending were launched, such as the Better Homes Movement, and various targeted women's and Negro consumer campaigns were launched. Marketing specifically to children kicked off with the first annual Macy's Parade in New York in 1924. Target marketing statistical analysis reached new levels of sophistication with the introduction of the punch card system. America had reached new and amazing heights in consumerism. Popular radio shows, the new talking movies, and song-dance combos such as the Charleston engaged millions and helped the decade become known as the Roaring Twenties. The chain store was born. Sears, Roebuck & Company opened 324 stores nationwide between 1925 and 1929. Woolworths, Kroger's, JCPenney and Walgreens all spread stores all over the country. Many people loved the convenience but hated that the small local merchants were forced out of business. The stock market climbed to new heights in the late 1920s. The ordinary American was encouraged to invest their savings in the stock market, and more Americans owned stock than ever before. But at the same time, the proportion of Americans on incomes below the poverty line continued to increase, so that this proportion reached about 50% by 1929 by many accounts. Campaign finance was absolutely out of control, with large companies like DuPont and General Motors giving lavish contributions to both parties. In a magazine called The Forum, in a July 1929 issue, a man called Norman Thomas wrote an article called Plutocracy in the Saddle about business domination of government and calling the two-party system the Tweedledublicans and the Tweedledemocrats. He also went on to say about the system of two parties in the pockets of big business. Quote, This is immensely better than having one dictator who might get shot, or one party which might provoke a rival organization based on principle. Two parties to stage a good show annually and a roaring circus every 4 years to divert the people. What could be better? A devout and reasonably shrewd captain of industry who does not daily thank God for this great gift of two parties, both his for the campaign contributions, is an ingrate. Indeed, its more sophisticated leaders may sometimes reflect how much better it is to teach people how to read and then give them what to read. Let them vote, but control the parties through which they vote, rather than, like the stupid Tsar of Russia, try to keep the masses illiterate and voteless. End quote. In the latter half of the 1920s, the public utilities were consolidating like crazy through a handful of holding companies, and in the process, they were raising consumer prices. As people found out later, they were also taking on huge amounts of debt, overvaluing assets and hiding losses from investors. Corporate profits were soaring throughout much of the 20s, generally thought to be due to increased consumer spending, increased credit availability, and increased efficiency. But there was a large part of this story not being told, lest it would offend the advertisers providing the revenue to the radio stations and newspapers. This was that of the conditions and wages of the non-union workers in the many factories, such as garments, candies, and so forth. In general, union membership declined drastically during the 1920s. There were sweatshop activists in those days too. You can find some of their reports online at the Library of Congress website. In one report by the Consumers League of New York entitled "Behind the Scenes in Candy Factories," you can read about the appalling conditions of women who worked in these factories and the wages of around $10 to $12 a week, which was considered well below a livable wage. The authors of this report actually went to work in these factories in order to learn about the conditions. There were also reports documenting abuses in the garment industry and a campaign to encourage labelling of garments with the conditions they were made in. This was all in stark contrast to the glamorous images of these products portrayed in the never-ending stream of advertising. A network of consumer activism popped up around the country, much of which was spearheaded by a Nader type by the name of Stuart Chase. In 1927, he co-authored a large study called Your Money's Worth, documenting the shoddiness of many mass-produced products, the false claims in advertising, and the trend for producers to make sure products would be replaced at frequent intervals. Comparing the consumer to Alice in a nonsensical wonderland, he found advertising industry correspondence with corporate clients that boasted that only 25% of purchases are based on real need, the rest being the product of salesmanship. On the financial side, Andrew Mellon was the Treasury Secretary for the whole decade of the 1920s. He was also one of the original founders of Alcoa, the Aluminium Company of America, exactly where our Treasury Secretary of 2002, Mr. Paul O'Neill, is from. And today, O'Neill is spookily sounding a lot like his predecessor of the 1920s. A fellow named Benjamin Strong, a J.P. Morgan man, was the director of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York at the time. His informal and totally private agreements with the head of the Bank of England, the Central Bank of England, Sir Montague Norman, to help England stay on the gold standard, led the Federal Reserve to make harmful interest rate cuts in 1927 that created excessive stock market speculation. This played a large part in the severity of the ultimate crash. These dealings between Strong in the US and Norman in England are documented in the diaries of Federal Reserve Board member Charles S. Hamlin, which are also readily accessible on the Library of Congress website. The British economist John Maynard Keynes was very critical of this move of England back to the gold standard, saying that, quote, "In truth, the gold standard is already a barbaric relic," end quote. He said this because the gold standard forced prices and wages to be set by international traders and speculators rather than by the needs of workers and consumers. Today, these prices and wages are still set by international speculators in our current environment of free capital flow and domination by a single reserve currency, the US dollar. This move by the Federal Reserve in 1927 to lower interest rates to help England stay on the gold standard encouraged stock speculators to borrow money at these low interest rates from the banks and then plow these borrowed funds back into the stock market. The banks themselves were directly engaged in a lot of these speculative activities because many of them also operated investment banking and brokerage businesses. This speculation continued until 1929, when in August the Federal Reserve raised interest rates. Stock prices reached their peak in September. The Dow Jones Index had doubled in just over a year. But then with the higher interest rates on borrowed speculative funds and nervousness that stocks were overvalued, stocks started falling in October. Banks started calling in the loans used to buy stock. On October 29, 1929, the other Black Tuesday, the Dow Jones Industrial Index crashed enough to wipe out this doubling of the Dow. The Dow and the markets as a whole started on a downward spiral that didn't bottom out until 1932. Many people just could not pay off their loans, and banks started going bankrupt all over the place from this and from the collapse of their own stock investments. After the crash, thousands of banks went out of business. There was, at this time, no federal insurance of bank deposits, and people saw not only their stock market investments disappear, but also their bank accounts vanish. For, even under the gold standard, bank money is nothing but the confidence that it can be used in trade. When that confidence disappears, so does money. And so does everything you worked for and transferred into those mysterious make-believe credits. If you need to refresh your memory about why money is simply an abstract notion and how it comes into existence, you can revisit Wizards of Money Part 1, entitled How Money is Created. Of course, America was still on the gold standard at the time of the crash. So compounding all these problems, the massive loss of confidence in the banking system caused the worst thing of all for the financial system, a run on banks, with people wanting to redeem their bank deposits and Federal Reserve notes for gold. But of course, there isn't enough gold under fractional reserve banking, and such a run on banks will always collapse it. Expectation of bank collapse is a self-fulfilling prophecy, as it is with the stock markets and as it is with any currency. When you have such lost confidence in the financial system, where there has just been complete dependence on it, the whole monetary system collapses. Money disappears because all it was confidence anyway. Everything, markets, trade, business, work, it all starts to grind to a halt. The financial house of cards collapses. And should we be afraid of what is? Well, just a pack of cards. Now let's get right into those post-crash days. Herbert Hoover was president at the time of the 1929 crash. In the subsequent depression, neither his administration nor the Federal Reserve did very much to bring the country out of the depression. This helped to get FDR elected, and he took office in 1933. As history goes, whenever a famous leader says something really important about big business, it doesn't get remembered very well at all. Instead, the large corporations who run the networks seem to have an uncanny knack of extracting only the short phrases that don't hurt revenues, don't offend anyone, and they play them over and over again so that no one will remember the important things that were said about their advertisers. And so it was with the FDR inauguration speech of 1933, where every man and his dog remembers,
"First of all, let me assert my firm belief that the only thing we have to fear is fear itself."
But how many people remember the other parts of the speech where FDR is talking about the bankers and the Wall Street speculators? Such harsh criticism of the wizards has never been heard since from an American president. So now I will play excerpts from this 1933 speech about the naughty wizards.
"And yet our distress comes from no failure of substance. We are stricken by no plague of locusts. Compared with the perils which our forefathers conquered, because they believed and were not afraid, we have still much to be thankful for. Nature still offers her bounty, and human efforts have multiplied it. Plenty is at our doorstep, but a generous use of it languishes in the very sight of the supply. Primarily, this is because the rulers of the exchange of mankind's good have failed through their own stubbornness and their own incompetence, have admitted their failure and have abdicated. Practices of the unscrupulous money changers stand indicted in the court of public opinion, rejected by the hearts and minds of men. True, they have tried, but their efforts have been cast in the pattern of an outworn tradition. Faced by failure of credit, they have proposed only the lending of more money. Stripped of the lure of profit by which to induce our people to follow their false leadership, they have resorted to exhortations, pleading tearfully for restored confidence. They only know the rules of a generation of self-seekers. They have no vision, and when there is no vision, the people perish. Yes, the money changers have fled from their high seats in the temple of our civilization. We may now restore that temple to the ancient truths. The measure of that restoration lies in the extent to which we apply social values, more noble than mere monetary profit. Happiness lies not in the mere possession of money. It lies in the joy of achievement, in the thrill of creative effort, the joy, the moral stimulation of work, no longer must be forgotten in the mad chase of evanescent profit.
These dark days, my friends, will be worth all they cost us
if they teach us that our true destiny is not to be ministered unto, but to minister to ourselves, to our fellow men. Recognition of that falsity of material wealth as the standard of success goes hand in hand with the abandonment of the false belief that public office and high political positions are to be valued only by the standards of pride of place and personal profits. And there must be an end to a conduct in banking and in business which too often has given to a sacred trust the likeness of callous and selfish wrongdoing. Small wonder that confidence languishes, for it thrives only on honesty, on honor, on the sacredness of obligations, on faithful protection, and on unselfish performance. Without them, it cannot live. We must act quickly. And finally, in our progress towards a resumption of work, we require two safeguards against a return of the evils of the old order. There must be a strict supervision of all banking and credits and investments. There must be an end to speculation with other people's money. And there must be provision for an adequate but sound currency. These, my friends, are the lines of attack.
And so the process for implementing regulation to provide checks and balances and bounds on the markets began. For it is only after such a collapse that the wizards actually realize that their success in their own game does ultimately depend on the people's willingness to play in it. The regulatory blitz of the Great Depression included all the landmark laws described earlier, plus many more. The regulations, of course, started first and foremost with the rulers of the exchange of mankind's goods and the money changers in their temple. The 1933 Glass-Steagall Act built a wall between banks, which are essentially the guardians of the public's money, and the brokers and investment banks, who are the primary gamblers in the exchanges. This would prevent privileged bankers from gambling with other people's money to make profits for themselves. Glass-Steagall also separated these institutions from insurance companies, who took on a completely different set of risks. To restore confidence in the banks and therefore rebuild the monetary system, 1933 also saw the birth of federal deposit insurance under the FDIC, or the Federal Depository Insurance Corporation. This insurance would guarantee that depositors would get all or most of their money back in the case of bank insolvency. It was realized that this insurance created a moral hazard for banks. Because deposits were backed by the federal government, banks had more of an incentive to take more risks. They could get more deposits by promising a higher return to depositors. With this money, they could invest in riskier, higher return assets to get higher profits. And the depositors wouldn't be too worried about this because they knew there was federal insurance on their deposits. This realization brought in a law that forbade paying interest on checking accounts so that banks couldn't do this. The separation of banks and other financial operations under Glass-Steagall also helped to prevent this undesirable, risky behavior of banks. Now, let's get in our time machine and fast forward to 2002. Glass-Steagall Act protections from bankers gambling with the public's money are gone. The restrictions on attracting deposits by paying interest on checking accounts are gone. But the federal deposit insurance and associated moral hazard are still with us. It is very interesting to study the memory loss that became evident during the final 1999 repeal of the 1933 Glass-Steagall Act that had built a wall between banking and speculation to protect depositors. It must be noted that Glass-Steagall had already been worn down to a low level of effectiveness. In years before 1999, financial and legal craftiness had exploited every loophole possible to circumvent Glass-Steagall. Regular deposit banking and lending, brokerage, investment banking, and insurance were already overlapping by 1999. But this was still within certain bounds imposed by Glass-Steagall. When the Gramm-Leach-Bliley Act kicked out Glass-Steagall, it enabled the formation of financial holding companies that could have interests across the spectrum of finance. The walls between the important public service of credit creation and safe storage of deposit monies and the speculative activities of brokerage and investment banking were torn down. Not as far down as they were in the 1920s, but getting there very fast. The death of Glass-Steagall enabled the formation of the financial holding companies, Citigroup and J.P. Morgan Chase, among others. Citigroup formed with the 1999 merger of Citibank and Travelers, who also owned the global investment banking and brokerage giant, Solomon Smith Barney. J.P. Morgan Chase & Company formed with the 2000 merger of investment banking brokerage giant J.P. Morgan and the regular banking giant Chase Manhattan. These are the largest banking institutions in the United States, and their deposits are backed by the U.S. taxpayer. In the savings and loans debacle of the 1980s that followed deregulation of savings and loans, we learned very well what happens when you combine federal insurance of deposits with deregulation of the investment activity of banks. The bank is, in essence, loaning out these deposits to make these investments for their own profit. But when the asset side of the bank is too risky, or maybe even make-believe, there is little backing for the deposit monies which people think are safe and sound. These monies actually did disappear, just as in the Great Depression, due to risky investments made by banks in what turned out to be worthless real estate and other investments. But because of the federal insurance on the deposits in the savings and loans debacle, the US taxpayer took on the responsibility of making sure the depositors got their money back. But now we enter the 21st century with two financial giants, J.P. Morgan Chase and Citigroup, as busy as ever, and the walls between safety and soundness in the monetary system and gambling in the equity markets fading into the distance. This is the big leagues now, and only time will tell what will happen. True, financial conglomerates must hold a separated set of assets against their banking deposits, i.e. the public's money, and they have what is known as risk-based capital requirements on those assets backing those deposits. This basically means that they hold an extra safety net of safe money, and this safety net is commensurate with the riskiness of the bank's investments. But, and here is the big thing that nobody seems to be noticing or worried about. Under the new rules being set by the G10 group of central bankers at the Bank for International Settlements in Basel, Switzerland, for the first time since capital requirements came in the aftermath of the SNL debacle and the Latin American debt crisis, large banks will be able to set these capital requirements for themselves within the next few years. That means capital levels or safety nets of banks will be essentially self-regulated. These new international bank supervision standards are called the Basel Capital Accords, and I spoke extensively about them in Wizards Part 2 on financial risk transfer. While you ponder the implications of self-regulation of the institutions we deposit our money in, at a time when they can both be banks and gamblers, please also consider the revelations of bank activity made during the Enron scandal. The Wall Street Journal reported on Tuesday, January 15th, that the SEC is investigating the role of Citigroup and J.P. Morgan Chase in financing so many of Enron's risky activities and secret partnerships. They are examining to what extent these banks help set up the partnerships and the lack of disclosure the banks presented about their own involvement. So far, we know that J.P. Morgan Chase has almost $3 billion exposure to Enron, and Citigroup has disclosed over $1 billion exposure, but others suspect there is more. Yet not all the deals between Enron and the two banking giants, particularly derivatives positions, have been fully unraveled and quantified. Other banks that were also involved in the riskier securities or derivatives deals with Enron and their secret partnerships were Bank of America, Credit Suisse First Boston, Deutsche Bank, and BNP Paribas. In particular, J.P. Morgan Chase, Citigroup, CS First Boston, and Wachovia were involved in the financing of one of the most controversial secret partnerships of all, the LJM partnerships headed by Enron's CFO, or Chief Financial Officer, Andy Fastow. A so-called sophisticated banker might say that this concern about banks self-regulating the level of their own safety net is ridiculous because banks have built such sophisticated risk management models to help them manage their risks in an optimal fashion. Indeed, the recognized leader in building these sophisticated risk management models is JP Morgan Chase, who built the widely used and distributed risk metrics system for managing financial risk. Wait, then one opens the January 21, 2002 issue of Business Week only to find an article entitled "The Perils of JP Morgan, Enron Argentina Bear Market. A year after the merger with Chase, the bank is racking up losses." It looks like JP Morgan is in trouble, from extensive exposure to failed internet companies, telecommunications companies, Enron, and various foreign gambles, as well as their leading role in what is known as the credit derivatives market that we can talk about in another edition of Wizards. So how well is this popular self-regulating risk management software working? It doesn't sound good. So where does that leave the depositor who thought his or her money was safe? Where does that leave the taxpayer who would have foot the bill if one of those big banks got in trouble? And what if the unthinkable happens, that the gambling activities of the banks cause such a huge loss in confidence that bank money disappears just like it did in the 30s and there isn't taxpayer money to bail out the banks? The last scenario might be considered a stretch in this day and age because we are not on the gold standard like we were when the Great Depression got underway. Roosevelt abolished gold convertibility in 1933, and the gold standard was only used after that to set exchange rates with other countries until 1971, when gold disappeared altogether from being a monetary standard. Without anything real backing money, and with the US dollar as the reserve currency of the world, the argument goes that if we ever had another panic like 1929, the Fed could pump liquidity into the markets as needed, like it did after the 1987 stock market crash. This means that the Fed can make money up, as we spoke about in Wizards Part 1, as needed to avoid massive default on bank loans and the collapse in bank investments that can make banks go under and people lose their deposits. But there is no guarantee that this will work. If confidence in the markets and the banks is lost to a large enough extent, the whole system may very well collapse, because the credits that make up money are 100% make-believe. The system only works because people have confidence in it. Expectation that the system could fail is a self-fulfilling prophecy. Oh, and there is one more thing that exists now that didn't exist in previous near collapses of the US banking system. This new thing is called the euro, the currency of the European Union, and it gives people somewhere else to park their money if they decide that US banks have gotten too risky. It also gives countries another reserve currency option, and some are starting to take it. The moral of today's story then: think carefully before you bank on the safety and soundness of the US banking system. Oh, and maybe start planting some vegetables in your backyard. That's all for Wizards of Money Part 10. Note that the Wizards of Money has a website where you can get all episodes of Wizards and the full text of episodes. The website is located at www.wizardsofmoney.org.
If you have an event you'd like us to announce or an issue you'd like us to cover on the program, you can contact us at our website at www.radioforall.org/unwelcome. That's radio, the number 4, ALL.org/unwelcome. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Unwelcome Guests is produced by Chris Sturr, Jesse Lind, Lynn Gary, and Sean Ewald. We are solely responsible for its content.